In Simon Van Boy's latest novel, Sipsworth, Helen Cartwright returns to the English village of her childhood after living in Australia for six decades. She's endured the deaths of both her husband and her son. At age 80, she decides she'd like to die too, and quickly. But then 3 years go by. Death does not come. Instead, life has continued for her where, quote, each day was an impersonation of the one before. But then something breaks up the monotony and the routine. It is a mouse. Sipsworth. This is Book Public from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. Yes, Helen Cartwright has been entirely alone and chooses to close herself off from the rest of the world outside her mustard-colored door. She'd considered doing away with the eponymous mouse, but changes her mind and even feels compelled to care for and consider someone other than herself. At first blush, the odd couple might seem to defy all reason and logic. Soon enough, the conviviality is such a natural part of the events that follow, some that will be surprising to readers at first, until they can see the ways that the friendship takes hold and even has implications for life outside the house on Westminster Crescent. I spoke to author Simon Van Boy about his novel, Sipsworth.
Helen Cartwright was old with her life broken in ways she could not have foreseen. Walking helped, and she tried to go out every day, even when it poured. But life for her was finished. She knew that and had accepted it. Each day was an impersonation of the one before, with only a slight shuffle, as though even for death there's a cue. Not a single person who glimpsed her bony figure flapping down Westminster Crescent could say they knew her. She was simply part of a background against which their own lives rolled unceasingly on. In truth, Helen Cartwright was native to the place, born in the old Park Hospital while her father fought at sea. The hospital was long gone, but the brick cottage where Helen had grown up was still there. Now and again she walked that way into town. The front garden had been paved over, but cracks in the cement sometimes bled flowers she could name, as though just below the surface of this world, the ones we remember, still going on. Her home now was a detached pensioner's cottage with a mustard door. She had purchased it through the internet after living abroad for 60 years. A lot can happen in six decades. A place can change. But she hadn't changed. Helen realized that the moment she'd gotten out of the airport taxi and stood before the new house on Westminster Crescent. The home she had given up on the other side of the world would have other people by now. She imagined them unrolling leaves of newspaper to reveal objects that were important or fragile, but in truth were just links in a chain that led you back to the beginning. No. She hadn't changed at all. She simply knew more because of all the things she'd been through. And contrary to the fairy tales told to her at bedtime as a child, anything of value she'd returned home with was invisible to anyone but herself. After the taxi chugged back to Heathrow Airport, Helen had gone inside and dropped her luggage at the foot of the stairs. Like all houses, this place had its own smell that would disappear once she was used to it. On the hall floor, beside her feet, were letters addressed to someone she didn't know. She wondered about the people who'd been here before, tried to imagine their lives, but kept returning the husband and son, now far beyond her reach. Still wearing her coat with the scent of aircraft cabin and coins forever loose in the seam, Helen walked through the kitchen and stood in the empty living room, stared out the front window. 100 times as a girl, she must have run, skipped, or ridden her clanking bike past this house. 100 times as a girl, without ever thinking it a place she would return one day to close her life in a perfect circle. On her 80th birthday, Helen spent the day moving things in the kitchen cupboard. wiping down shelves, vacuuming the stairs, turning from any face that appeared in the dust or the darkness between cans. 3 years passed with nothing to fill their pockets. Then early one morning, something happens.
I wonder if you would summarize Sipsworth for our listeners, mostly because I'm afraid I'm going to say too much. And I think I'd love instead for listeners who have not yet read the book to find it, to read it, and to encounter all the things that I really want to talk about and to discover that on their own. So I'm going to ask you then, what is your book jacket synopsis? And then I'm going to take cues from you so I don't spoil everything as I talk to you about this book.
Okay. I suppose the book is about somebody who's given up on life, who's extraordinarily lonely, but doesn't have any desire to meet other people or to socialize. And she's really just waiting to die. She's outlived her life. She's lost her husband and son, and anyone she wanted to love or did love is gone. And then one day, a lost pet, a stray animal, decides it's going to move in with her. And the book is about their relationship and what happens to both of them as they get to know each other.
Helen Cartwright is this woman. The part you just read, she's 80 years old, 3 years on, she's 83. How was it that you came to write about Helen, who's 83 years old, this particular character, a woman in her 80s? And how it is that you could enter that space of the rooms of her mind? And I imagine if it hasn't happened yet, that it very well will happen, that women around this age will tell you that you nailed this depiction of Helen Cartwright.
Yeah, that's a good question. And I was a bit worried about it, but so far so good. Anne Patchett liked it. And she's not in her 80s. I think she's in her 50s. But you know, I have had feedback from people, octogenarians, and they've loved it. So that's a big sigh of relief. And I think the reason I was able to maybe to even consider attempting it was because when I was in college, I worked briefly at a nursing home. So I would help look after men and women in their 80s. And I sort of got to see some of their interior lives. You know, what happens to the mind when the body starts failing, and sometimes the mind too. I also work as an EMT here in New York City. And probably about 30% of my patients are senior citizens. So I, you know, and I often encounter them during a crisis. So I see where they live. I talk to them. I find out, you know, their histories and things like that. And it really is just eye-opening, and it's shocking how difficult, how hard it is to be old, to be 80, 90 years old, because not only is, you know, do you have to have constant medical appointments, but, you know, people you would have relied on to help you might no longer be around. And in some cases, there are some short-term memory issues. And so, you know, it's hard enough negotiating the healthcare system when you're in your 40s, let alone, you know, when you're twice that age. So, you know, my experience with people in their 80s coping with life has come about as a result of my EMT work, mostly.
Well, I want to say a couple of things. Anne Patchett said she loves this book, not likes it. She loves it. It's a slight correction there.
Thank you.
And the other thing is about this idea of the day-to-day life of Helen Cartwright. So I understand, I mean, I know from being such a fan of your work over the years that you have these powers of observation, but I feel like this is on another level. And it's not just because she's a woman, and it's not just because she's in her 80s. There's something, it's on another level. And part of it is this way that, you know, we're with her for a couple of weeks, every day and all day. I love the details, for instance, related to music and the programs that she watches. It's music in the early part of the day and television in the afternoon and the evening, the movies she watches, how she feels excited when she realizes that the movie's in black and white, and she tucks her feet under her, and she's like extra excited about that prospect. I feel like to create a character like this and also go into that level of detail of, I kept thinking, I think Simon really knows when Helen Cartwright's birthday is and what her favorite color is. I feel like you must have notes about Helen Cartwright, like you just know everything about her. And those kinds of details, if we're going to enter the space of this novel where we are with her all, what's the novel about? Well, we're with Helen Cartwright all day, every day for a period of time. She's 83 years old, and this is what she does. And it grabs us somehow. We're in it with her. And of course, the discovery of the stray animal helps things along too. There's a lot of activity there. The Katharine Hepburn movie that Helen watches, I think it must be summertime.
It is summertime.
Yes. And she watches it one Saturday night. And you write, the last scene is of the heroine on a train, a woman who knows she is moving away from the best part of her life toward the version in memory that will come to define her. That bit for me is, it has got to be for a woman of a certain age, such a profound realization, such a difficult realization, but and so profound, but also inevitable in its way too. So that too, I feel like the way that you can enter the space of Helen Cartwright. I don't have a question about that. I think I just wanted to send that across to you about how meaningful that is. I feel like to be able to not just in some gratuitous way decide this will be an 83-year-old woman, but to really, you really, really seem to understand a day in the life of an 83-year-old woman. And here it is on the page.
Thank you very much.
So I read The Presence of Absence and remembered the name Sibsworth, if you can believe that, from back then and a couple of years ago in the introductory information of that book. And
You're a sharp reader.
oh, I notice all kinds of things that I'm not going to ask you about because I like the mystery of them. But it does become a very important name in this book. I wonder if you can talk about Sibsworth.
Yeah, he was an actual bona fide mouse. He was my pet mouse, actually. And when I remember when we were, I don't want to say by him, but when we were adopting him, let's say it's a bit gentler. When we were adopting him from the shop, from the pet shop, he was trying to get a drink from the water bottle, the upside down bottle, and all the other mice were just pushing him away. And my wife said, "Look at that! That's so rude. They won't even let him get a Sipsworth." And that's how he got. I thought, "Oh, Sipsworth, not just a sounds like a butler or a country house, doesn't it?" But so that's how he got his name. And there were two mice actually. I had my first mouse I bought during the pandemic, and we ended up he had a disease actually, so I had to feed him with a syringe, twice a day, and but he took his medicine like a good mouse, and he only lived to 8 months, which isn't bad for a mouse. I mean, the Sibsworth lived for over 2 years, but Tiresias, with his lung condition, Mycoplasma pulmonis, which is like COPD in humans, he lived 8 months, and we took a cross-country trip together, not so I could show him America before he died, but because I had to work in Los Angeles during the pandemic, and you can't take mice on aeroplanes, so unless it's a private jet. So if anyone has a private jet, just text me, and I'll know for the future. But so I had to drive from New York to Los Angeles with Tiresias, and I rigged out this special thing in the car where, there was a special shield where I could move it so the sun wouldn't shine on his travel enclosure. I had to make sure that I didn't stop for too long, 10 minutes tops because of the AC and his lung condition. And then I would smuggle him into the hotel every night. I wore a suit, shirt and tie, so that people wouldn't think that man's got a mouse in his pocket.
Right, who would ever suspect?
Yeah. So that was fun. We went to the beach. I showed him, we went through the Rockies. I mean, it was like he saw more states than most people I know. And then on the way back, he died in Las Vegas, like Elvis.
A couple of things that you write. If it wasn't for mice, our jobs would be even harder. Billions have died in labs. Animals are really just children that never grow up. So there, you can, I can say to somebody, oh, I'm reading this book called Sipsworth, and it's about this 83-year-old woman who takes in this stray mouse. Mouse. That's the novel? Yes, that is absolutely the novel. And I don't know how you did it. Because there is this section about Helen having to go to purchase glue traps, or she thinks she wants to do away with the mouse. She thinks she wants to get rid of this problem. And then, of course, I want the reader to find out what happens. But you know a lot about glue traps, and I have to tell you, there's so much that's also very funny in this novel. For instance, and again, this is a part that I would love the reader to just encounter, but something that happens to Helen with the glue traps. There's so much that's funny and human and so realistically drawn. I mean, imagine someone alone in the house, and what could possibly happen when she's trying to capture the mouse or get rid of the mouse or lure the mouse, and all of the sort of things that can go wrong and go very right. But you've answered the question. So you had your, I've seen a photo of you with your pet mice. And also a photo of you with some crocheted mice. I thought that was
Yes.
very beautiful.
I try and support local artists.
How wonderful. But did you get any pushback from your publisher when you said, oh, and then there's a mouse? Was there sort of that moment of, or do they just trust you because you're Simon Van Boy and they might be able to pull it off?
Well, I like to write whatever I'm supposed to write. What I mean to say is that when I sit down to write, I'm not really sure what story I'm going to tell. Often I don't have any ideas. I get inspired by something or by a person or by a word or a look or just an action or just some small thing. There'll be an emotional connection. And then I'll sort of sit down and start typing and explore that. And then I'll just see where it goes. So it's a very much an instinctual process. And whatever I write, it's almost like an Irish mother. What you have for dinner is what she's cooked for dinner. There's no sense of like, it's not a restaurant. Whatever is cooked, that's what you eat. So in that sense, I really just write what I feel I should be writing and what I feel like is most wholehearted. And then I work on it and give it to my publisher. And hopefully they like it and they want to publish it.
This entire life of Helen Cartwright, it is full of a kind of sorrow and longing for the past. Even though what she's hearkening back to and recalling is also very sad. Her childhood was so solitary. Her dad was maybe shell-shocked or had PTSD. Ball of hers in the well that she mentions a few times really marked her life, it seems like. And she recalls it over and again and even recalls it to Sipsworth. It occurs to me that this is the way we recall our childhood, not as glory days, but as just what it was.
It's so true.
It's true, and I came to this from reading the book. She's not recalling the happy times, but she's recalling these other times, and they are so realistically drawn. But there too, again, is this idea of Helen Cartwright as somebody. This is something that I love about this book, that she's 83. Her life is still very important. Her life has always been important. You know, there's this thing that women, I think, around my age and older, feel that we're invisible, that people don't see us anymore, that we've sort of lost our value in a certain way. when I was much younger, I used to hear women talk about that, and I thought, how can that be? That's never going to happen. And it does happen even sooner than I think your 50s. I'm not sure. That's everybody's situation. But the idea of a novel that's centered on this person and that the things that she recalls, I am all in for. I am all about it. I want to know more about not just her past when she was young, but I want to know more about how she's getting on in the day to day. But there is this very sort of enigmatic thing about she is so solitary. Why did she return to this house? What is she going to do? And that hangs over the story for the duration until Sipsworth. And the rest is around Cecil and the librarian and Dom and these other characters. And I don't want to say much more, even though I do want to just shout it into the mic, but there these other things that just become so critical in the story. But yeah, I just had to say that about Helen Cartwright. Not just, well, she's 83, she's 83, she's 83, but there's so much more to it than that. She's living. She's alone. She's a bit of a misanthrope. For a little bit, it seems like a little agoraphobic, not sure, but that's the point, is how complex she actually is. She's not one dimensional.
There's a big surprise in the middle about her life.
Yes. Should we say? No, we should not say. We should.
No, because I feel like I wanted it to be such an interesting surprise for the reader in the middle of the book.
It's such a surprise. It should stay a surprise for everybody. But yes, but just how multidimensional. I just have to say that. How multidimensional she is, right down to the way that she shops for groceries. Here's an example that I shared with my mother over the phone yesterday, that when Helen goes to shop and everything looks so delicious, and it just seems like she could just be the happiest person, she can buy all the treats she wants and go home and eat to her heart's content. But when she gets home, as you write, that her appetite is very thin. For a person, I think, who lives alone, this is a very real thing.
When I've worked with some people, in their 80s, they have said that, this doesn't taste properly, this doesn't taste right, but there's something wrong with it. But it's not actually the food, it's just that their taste buds are changing and, things just don't taste right to them. Things that they once had, that once had flavor. In some cases, older people, it doesn't taste, the taste doesn't taste how they remember.
That's so interesting. When we're babies, our taste buds, there's just an explosion of every other thing. The bitter is really bitter and the sour is really sour, right? So it stands to reason as we get older, they're still changing. Yeah. Like any other part of us. The structure of this novel is kind of genius in that it takes place over a couple of weeks. I started to make an outline for each of the days.
Oh, really?
Yes. And it is very much like a day in the life of someone who lives alone, who isn't mobile, who can't just like hop in the car and go somewhere, but can still have a very full day of routines and rituals, of treating herself, as I alluded to before. And I wonder, so I've watched some of your videos on YouTube about craft. I wondered how you decided on this structure, which I have to say, when I first read The Presence of Absence the first time, also has a very particular kind of structure. And I thought, what a genius thing that when you can settle on the structure, however that comes to you, that you can sort of, and I don't know if this is true or not, but that you have something to sort of latch on to and sort of dig in. And it can be such a guiding principle, and what I'm sure is a very long process, a very involved process. Did it help the writing once you hit on that structure?
Yeah, it allowed me to focus on the difficulty of the structure, which is, one real main character, one main human character, and her life for a few weeks. Because, when you're that close in as a reader, if anything's wrong, if she doesn't have the daily weather forecast, or if the handle on the door isn't loose like it was 3 days ago, anything that's not consistent will break the spell. So this is the first time I've written a book that was just straight through, no flashbacks, just, real time. And it was hard because everything has to be, I mean, the danger is it gets very boring because we're just with this person. But the thing is, people's lives aren't boring to themselves. So how can I convey the elements of her life in a way that's not boring, but also nothing happens in a way? Nothing's happening. It's just her routine. But of course, so that's why the arrival of the mouse is such a huge thing, because she's been in this same routine for years, for 3 years. And then suddenly, like, everything's thrown into disarray because she's brought a mouse into the house that wants to be her best friend. So, what's she going to do now? How's she going to go out shopping? Should she leave the mouse alone? Like, everything has to be questioned. And I think that, in some cases, when people have a disruption to their routine or to their comfort zone, it can be quite good. It forces the brain to start thinking and be creative again.
Yes, and she has to think about somebody else. And
Yeah.
yeah. And again, and just the idea that it's a mouse. It's not a dog. It's not a cat. It's not a parakeet. It's not a gerbil or a hamster either. It's a mouse. And that becomes, and I'll say this, just this, then that becomes very important just on its own, just the idea that it is a mouse. So I love a book where I had to look up faffing.
Oh, faffing. Is that even a word?
mean, contextually, I could figure it out, but and I've heard the word knackered, of course, but you really put us in this place. But it made me think about this idea that we say in writing, especially in creative nonfiction, I guess, that the more specific the detail is, the more universally appreciated it can be.
That's lovely. I agree with that. Yeah, the older I get, and the more books I write, the more I'm attracted to the intense interior of a person's life. Yeah, how a person feels. I know I have to have plot and all these things, to keep the pacing there. But I'm really interested in just how other people feel, their experience of life, and you know that feeling where you've been watching television and the light has been slowly draining, and then suddenly the television has lit up the room because from outside the light has drained, and you realize it's 4 o'clock or 4:30, and which is Jean-Paul Sartre said, it's too late for most things but too early for everything else. 4 o'clock. Well, nothing really happens at 4 o'clock, but the idea of somebody just sitting in a room. So I like the idea of a person's interior. So, if for your listeners now, whether they're driving or you're sitting in a chair, I'm thinking about what kind of chair you're sitting in. I'm thinking about what your hands look like. I'm wondering, like, do you have the air conditioning on, and what sound does it make? And I'm wondering what you're looking forward to, and I wonder what are the things you're worried about. So I want so desperately to, for my private world, to communicate with your private world.
Well, for Helen Cartwright and for Sipsworth, that's alchemy that works so beautifully. Simon Van Boy, thank you so much for talking to me today. What an honor, what a
Thank you
thrill.
for having me. Are you kidding? I appreciate you.
Thank you so much, Simon.
Thanks, Yvette. I'll talk to you soon.
Simon Van Boy is the author of Sipsworth. It's published by Godin Books. He's the award-winning and best-selling author of more than a dozen books for children and adults. Raised in North Wales, he currently lives between London and New York, where he's a book editor and a volunteer EMT for Central Park Medical Unit. In early 2020, he rescued his first mouse. This has been Book Public from Texas Public Radio. Write to us at bookpublic@tpr.org. Chica Brizzotti composed our theme music. Dan Katz is Texas Public Radio's news director. I'm Eva Benavides.